From downtown Milwaukee, welcome to Money Talk with Bob Landis. Each week, professional advisors from Landis & Company Investments discuss the latest financial developments, offering timely insight and long-term perspective.
This is Money Talk for August 7th, 2020. Your Milwaukee Bucks play the Dallas Mavericks Saturday in the Orlando bubble. And this weekend, the Brew Crew will be at home with the Reds at Miller Park. Okay, using a biblical term, it's the end of days. Well, that may be a little overly dramatic, but we're close. Let me just say before we get into it, all of these stories are absolutely true. Remember the movie The Planet of the Apes? The gorillas captured Charlton Heston and took over planet Earth? Yeah, like that could happen. Well, guess what? According to the Sunday London Times, a British safari park has a roving gang of baboons armed with knives and a chainsaw. The big old monkeys are vandalizing vehicles, ripping off mirrors and windshield wipers. And that's how it all begins. Or how about this interesting and scary fact? Hippo sweat is blood red and it acts as a sunscreen and a bug repellent and the stuff nightmares are made of. And finally, ripped from the headlines of CNN, zombie cicadas. You heard that right. Zombie cicadas, under the influence of a mind-controlling fungus, have returned to West Virginia. Well, there goes the neighborhood. All right, on the podcast today, we have Brian Kilk, Steve Giles, and wrapping up the week, here's Kyle Tedding.
Well, thanks for that great opening, Max. It was a good week for stocks again, with the NASDAQ adding 2.5% this week, closing today at the bell at 11,011. The S&P 500 up 2.5% as well, closing today at the bell at 3,351. The Dow Jones Industrial Average up this week 3.8% to close at the bell at 27,435. And for the year, the Dow Jones Industrial Average now down 2.6%. The S&P recovering, the end-of-year highs up now 4.8% for the year, including dividends, and the NASDAQ up a stellar 23.3%. Just further the divide between value and growth stocks here, further to the divide between a lot of the technology and more growth-oriented names in the NASDAQ index and much of the rest of the market. So, that continues to be a theme that we look at, despite the fact that I think, the 30-stock Dow had a better week than NASDAQ did overall. I think the other thing worth pointing out is that the S&P now a stretch of six consecutive positive days, its best run of positive days since April of 2019. And so, we haven't seen any incredibly large moves to the upside, but it's just been slow and steady for much of the broad market indexes. An encouraging sign for investors. Typically this time of year, things are quiet anyways. And so we haven't expected much from stock market returns, but ultimately to see six consecutive days to the upside, I think is a sign that at least investors feel somewhat encouraged about kind of the path forward. Brian, as we start things off here, I think just about everybody that we talk to in our professional lives and our daily lives know what we do for a living, and they all want to know what we think about what's going on in the world. And some of it may just be to affirm the opinions they already hold themselves, but some of it is that they're generally curious. And so, one of the things that you and I talked about, I know you're getting asked, one of the things that I get asked all the time is, when we finally get past the virus issues, when we reach herd immunity or when we have a vaccine, isn't it time for the market to really take off? Isn't it time for, with all that uncertainty gone, isn't it time for things to really get back to the stellar returns that we saw in 2019? And, I know you've got an answer for that question, but, from my perspective, I think there's a variety of reasons to go, hey, maybe there's a few reasons to hold off here. I wonder what your thoughts are on that, though.
Well, Kyle, I think I have an opinion that might be different than an answer, right? I always got a lot of opinions. But I think, we're in this kind of struggle between, I think, what you would think if you looked at pricing in the market right now and the way Wall Street's reacted and to some of the anecdotal, more emotional side of how people feel about things. I mean, you and I are in these conversations all day where people are really distraught about stuff and yet the market continues to take off. And so you kind of, as you look ahead, kind of wonder where in that spectrum are we going to end up? Are we going to end up perhaps on the positive side of things, as Wall Street suggests? Or are there potential stumbling points out there, places where things are going to fall apart and some of those fears that we hold deep are realized? And I think every week, like this week, when we get some data, it's another chance to kind of revisit and recalibrate where we are on that spectrum. And I think for the most part, a lot of the economic data this week was actually pretty positive, was actually reaffirming. I mean, even some of the earnings news, which we can get into, is, I think, reassuring. But it's hard for me not to look into the long-term lens and just remind people that there are going to be some struggles still, you know. And I think even to the degree that a somewhat optimistic outcome is achieved in the months ahead, that, you look beyond there, there's still challenges, there's still some hurdles, still a pretty strong likelihood that the economy itself won't get back to where it was last year for quite some time. And the market's, pricing out a whole bunch of months. So even if we have that optimistic outcome, there's not a lot of room for stocks to run because of where they're priced.
Yeah, Brian, I think that's a great point and a good segue to kind of what I think has been going on with earnings. And in particular, Steve, you look at the second quarter for earnings, we had thought that perhaps we'd see a 40% decline. And it's looking a little more like maybe it's going to be 30% decline. But, what's the difference between a 40% decline or a 30% decline? If you're holding stocks, it probably isn't all that significant. And yet markets have rallied, and yet I think markets are looking beyond simply where we are today into the future. And, I think as we're fond of saying, it's all about earnings and interest rates, but, kind of what are you thinking and what are you talking about right now as it relates to the earnings picture?
Well, Kyle, I think it's interesting that a lot of the clients I'm speaking with do recognize that the markets are a leading indicator. And the optimism we're getting from the markets, and yes, the earnings numbers weren't as bad, but still, you've got a 10.2% unemployment rate. One out of five workers are still looking for a job from what we had at the beginning of the year. And those are real numbers. And I think investors recognize that this is going to be a long slog. And to Brian's point, you just got to take each week as it comes. And some weeks the data is not as good as you would hope. And other weeks the data is a little bit better than you would hope. And for me, it reinforces the importance of building balanced portfolios.
Kyle, I kind of look for those sorts of things that kind of are maybe unexpected. And I would point maybe to Toyota's earnings this week and their forecast for $7 billion in profit, over the calendar year. And that's certainly a positive surprise in a industry maybe you wouldn't expect one. We all think Amazon's dropping stuff off at Steve's house every other day, that they're doing pretty well, but you wouldn't expect it from a car manufacturer. So I think, that's potentially pretty good news, And I think on the other side, you got to have that conversation about the big growthy companies and how expensive they are. And can what happens when everything settles down? Will the rest of the world catch up, or will they falter and people maybe appreciate that there's going to be a struggle to catch up earnings with ultimately what they're paying for those big companies,
Yeah, Brian, I think what we've been dealing with is investors that are willing to buy up two things, and they've ignored everything else in the market. They're buying lottery tickets, they're buying the opportunity for some company that's going to come out of nowhere and really surprise, and they're buying sure things on the earnings front. And the sure things on the earnings front have been the technology names. It's been some of those healthcare growth stocks that, have prospects that are going to lead to pretty strong earnings growth over the next 3, 4, 5 quarters. But longer term, I think as you rightfully point out, it's not strictly going to be those companies. You're going to have Toyota show up. You're going to have, maybe some value stocks show up. And so, I think we have the conversation every week about whether it's value or growth right now. And I think, that's an interesting conversation to have short term, because growth has done so well, because technology stocks have done so well. But remember that longer term, that conversation might look a little different than what it looks like right now, that I think we have opportunities. I mean, I think the other thing that's emerged in this earnings season is that, we're operating in more uncertainty than we have ever operated in before. And so it's typical to see, us overshoot on earnings estimates and then come back down a little bit as we approach the quarter. And then for those actual earnings reports, when they come out to beat those estimates that had been backed up, that had been backed down to a more realistic number. But what we've seen recently is that, I think we cut earnings forecasts pretty substantially knowing how bad things had gotten. And all of a sudden, it was a lot better than what we thought. It's still terrible, but it's a lot better than what we thought. And so I think the question that's left is, you know, what that means for a company like Toyota that you point out, but also what it means for those growth stocks. And so as we look ahead, as you look at, you know, what I think so often we like to point out is what are the next 12 months of earnings look like? Every week that goes by, we're adding significantly to that 12-month forecast, in part because the week we took off, the week that just passed, was a terrible week for earnings. And the week that we're adding on to the end is supposed to be a pretty great week for earnings. And so, you know, the further along this goes, the better the forward PE of the market looks, the better that, you know, those valuations look. And so while we talk about a forward PE of 23, you know, roughly right now for the S&P 500 being fairly expensive, I think as you look to, okay, what does the forward PE look like on full year 2021 earnings, things look considerably better. As you look at what it looks like for the next 18 months, for the next 2 years, I think it's a very different story than what we're talking about right now. And as I said, I think some of that is all of the uncertainty of the environment we're operating in. And some of it is that we aren't necessarily forecasting where some of that growth is going to come from yet because we just can't see it.
Well, Brian and Kyle, one question I keep asking myself, as optimistic as the market seems to have been, and yes, it is a leading indicator, how much of that is assuming that this 10.2% unemployment rate is going to get back down to the 3 or 4% range? I think a lot of jobs that were lost are not going to come back. So what industries are going to absorb those workers? Are those workers going to be willing to change careers, change their sectors that they had all that experience in and go in a different direction? And what will be interesting, I think, for our economy is seeing how things change as we move through the next couple of quarters and the next couple of years.
You know, and to both your points, I think what it says to me or suggests to me perhaps is not that markets are going to be up or down. I've talked about this quite a bit in the last few weeks, that there's this dichotomy between different kinds of companies and that there may be some companies and industries where you know, the future earnings will sustain growth and there are opportunities there. On the flip side, you know, so much of what's held up the markets has been concentrated in these few companies. And kind of to your side of the thing, Steve, you know, well, you know, I had a client say to me this week, yeah, you can't look at earnings when you're looking at those big companies because it's all about market share, this, that, and the other thing. And I'm like, well, maybe in the short run, that's true. But in the long run, somebody's going to have to make money, you know, and to the degree you've priced in future earnings, you know, even if you've priced in 3 or 4 or 5 years, at some point in time, you know, somebody's going to come calling. So I think there's going to be a lot of differentiation in the marketplace going forward, and there will be opportunities based on realistic expectations. And I think there's going to be perhaps, you know, a little bit of, you know, paying the piper with some companies that may have gotten ahead of themselves in this time of safety and looking to those few to kind of carry the weight of the markets. So we'll see, you know.
You know, Brian, I think one of my favorite things about this kind of environment is just how much it forces companies to change to the times we're living in. And some of that is, you know, Steve, as you mentioned, with the unemployment rate where it is, that a lot of those people aren't coming back to work because businesses have learned to operate leaner. Businesses have learned to do things from home instead of going into the office. And so they're not going to need as much office space. They may not need, you know, the resources that they once needed. But it also means that businesses are doing different things than they did before. That, yeah, now you need more technology than you ever needed because you need to support workers that are working remotely. Now, you know, for example, businesses that are doing completely different things than what they did before, entering new business units that they haven't taken part of it before. And so, you know, you look at somebody like Eastman Kodak, who for decades has been kind of at the forefront of, you know, photography, been at the forefront of film, and all of a sudden, you know, their business was essentially ripped out from under them as you transition to a universe of digital photography. And all of a sudden, Eastman Kodak has decided, yeah, we're going to take a Defense Production Act loan to become a pharmaceutical company. And so, you know, I think that's the opportunity that we don't necessarily see coming. It's the opportunity that when we talk about earnings for the S&P being $142 over the next 12 months, yeah, but what about all those companies that find new businesses that they never thought they'd be in before? It's why long-term being able to adapt and long-term being able to do things that people don't expect of you makes you a more profitable business. It makes you a more attractive business. And it's why, yeah, the conversation about market share makes a lot of sense. But if you don't even know what company if you don't even know what market a company is going to be operating in a year from now, how can you have a conversation about market share? It's about, you know, the business's ability to adapt. And so, you know, I'm all on board with saying, yeah, you've got to have earnings. I'm all on board with saying, yeah, you know, there's a lot of hurdles. But the other side of that, I think, is that, you know, you've got to have management teams in these businesses that are willing to adapt to what's going on.
Hey, Kyle, maybe Eastman Kodak should buy TikTok if they want to stay in the photo business.
Yeah, that's that one's probably a third rail not worth touching right now.
You know, Kyle, your point is such a good point, you know, and it's as you say, it's not even just the companies, but you kind of made a reference to real estate. I mean, if commercial real estate's going to flounder, which, you know, I think most of us would suggest it will, everybody moving to, you know, what do we think, maybe 20% of the workforce will continue to work from home. Well, maybe that's what sends residential real estate back on the radar screen, because it's lagged for a long time. So, you know, one loss one direction, one gain in the other. How does it all add up at the end of the day? That's what we don't know. But certainly, I think there will be opportunities to do well, even if the broader picture continues to be challenging.
And Brian, maybe a saving grace for U.S. businesses right now is just how much cash they're sitting on. And you look at, you know, small businesses that were afforded these PPP loans where roughly 50% of that money has left the door, but they're still sitting on the other half of that cash. You look at larger U.S. corporations, publicly traded corporations sitting on, we'll call it $2.5 trillion in cash, and that's up by maybe a half a trillion or 500 billion from the end of the year. What happens with all that cash? What's the cost, I guess, for these companies continuing to sit on that cash? And why, you know, I think the obvious question is, why are they doing it? But the more important question is, what happens when they finally decide to start spending it?
So I think that's one of the more fascinating questions that we've covered in a long time. And Steve, you had mentioned TikTok. Well, Microsoft has almost $140 billion in cash and a lead in the charge of the cash hoarders. And at some point in time, Kyle, how long have you and I talked about this? Years now. The extensive amount of cash out there now, you know, even made infinitely greater by, you know, what the government's thrown into the pile in the last few months. But at some point in time, that cash has to go somewhere. And when and how will it go to somewhere very productive and useful to the economy? You're starting to see merger and acquisition numbers start to rise in the last few weeks. That's the kind of stuff that I think will really, you know, kind of support the point you made earlier about how are people going to be innovative and how are they going to change, switch gears and find ways into new markets and new ways to be profitable as the world continues to evolve through this. So I think one of the things I'd say about the last week or two is this idea that some of this cash is being deployed into mergers and acquisitions is really a positive sign.
You know, Brian, you mentioned the cash that's been poured into the system in response to this, you know, pandemic, this global pandemic. And I think one of the logical concerns, and it was a concern post-financial crisis, is that the amount of money that's poured in means that inflation is just around the corner. And I think as we learned post-financial crisis, that money pooled on balance sheets, as it's doing now, that money flowed to those people who weren't going to spend it anytime soon because they were waiting for more certainty. And that certainty never necessarily arrived in the way we thought it would. And so we went from, you know, I think banks in the financial crisis being very concerned about what their business was going to look like, and certainly a number of other businesses, to those banks being forced to capitalize those other businesses thinking, yeah, I'd rather just have 100 or 150 billion on my balance sheet than spend it all and then be forced to try to go back to the capital markets and borrow at unfavorable costs. And I think the uncertainty of all of that has meant that cash didn't move through the system as quickly as we assumed it would. It meant that inflation wasn't a problem. And that doesn't mean that's what's going to happen this time. Certainly, I think there are reasons to think that the magnitude of the cash that has been spent long-term could be inflationary. I think certainly there's reasons to believe that the cash might finally make its way through the system as companies go through the M&A process, as they buy new technologies to help remote workers. All those are things that could spur demand. But, you know, I think the short answer is we're just not seeing those inflationary pressures. People don't have places to spend money yet. And so you know, one of the conversations we've had with some of our that I've had with some of our advisors is, well, what do I do for clients that want that inflation protection? You know, I think an obvious answer is you buy the thing that has inflation in the name and the inflation protected bonds or the Treasury inflation protected bonds. And yeah, that's one answer, but it may not be the best answer. You know, Brian, Steve, I know you both have this conversation with clients. I know we've talked about it for years, but there's alternatives to just strictly, you know, buying inflation protection for clients that want to have a little bit, you know, a little bit of an advantage if we do enter that inflationary environment finally.
Kyle, the best inflation protector is going to be stocks. It's why we're in the business that we're in. You want to outpace inflation longer term, build a diversified portfolio of stocks and stock mutual funds.
It's such a great point, Steve. I think pricing power is really critical to the success of businesses long term. And if you have inflation, you are by default giving those businesses some pricing power. If their costs are rising, it also means that everyone else's costs are rising. And so the idea is that they can raise their prices. If they can raise them proportionately to what their margins are, then all of a sudden you've got a business that is growing earnings. And it may not be the way we'd hope for it to grow earnings, but it's one more component of how long term you can grow earnings and make those stocks, I think, a little bit more attractive.
Well, clients love knowing that they invest in a balanced mix of funds that can give them a raise every year to outpace that inflation component, where so many of my clients are on their fixed pensions that they've been collecting for years, and those fixed pensions, they don't go up. But what they've been able to draw off of their portfolio, because their portfolio has increased in value, because they have seen compounded returns, they get asked for a raise every year from their 401k plans. And, you know, that alone is the biggest argument for having stocks as a way to outpace inflation.
You know, Kyle, I think the other thing I would say, and Steve, I couldn't agree with you more, but I don't know, it seems to me like there has to maybe be some deflationary pressure before there's inflationary pressure. I mean, I think if you look at the economy prior to COVID, there was a fair amount of capacity, you know, and maybe excess capacity, which now if you drop demand, aggregate demand 10%, you got a whole bunch more. You got a lot more deflationary pressure than you have inflationary pressure, you know, and people are going to need to offload their products. They're going to need to keep in the sales game. And I just see it as being potentially pretty challenging for a while for anybody to get away with any kind of price appreciation, which might lead to inflation. Now, having said that, boy, it seems pretty obvious at some point in time, we're going to have to pay for all this money flying around. And unless we do something constructive to work our way through it, inflation will be pretty much the natural outcome somewhere down the road.
Well, and let's be honest, I don't think any of us are calling for inflation, as you say, anytime soon. I think the saving grace to all of this is that we don't have to be right on what the inflation rate is, and we don't have to be right on when it shows up. We just have to be right that the tools we have available to us are sufficient to overcome whatever those pressures are. And so, you know, Steve, as you point out, the ability to keep a significant portion of your portfolio in stocks is more than you're going to need to be able to keep pace with that, with those inflationary pressures. And so, you know, I think it isn't necessarily about whether or not you know what the inflation rate is going to be. It isn't necessarily about whether or not you know what's going to come. It's that you just keep enough tools available that you can overcome whatever those risks are.
And then maybe a final comment on that whole topic is that there's a reason why you don't want to be overly cautious right now too. You know, Steve's point about stocks and inflation and the idea that we really can't time these things and predict when the winds might shift. You know, I have some folks out there that are pretty nervous right now, and I'm all for hunkering down and keeping it close to the vest for a while. But, you know, there are problems you create in being overly cautious as well. And I think the idea that inflation might creep up sooner than later would certainly be one of those reasons why you wouldn't want to be overly cautious too soon. So.
Yeah, I think, you know, when we talk about how we invest portfolios, I fall back to what's our default position, right? We can let the portfolio get a little more aggressive. We can let it get a little more conservative. But, you know, if you just walked in off the street and said it's a typical day, it's typical forward multiples, it's a typical earnings environment, an inflation environment, interest rate environment, everything is just average. How would you invest for me? How would you invest my portfolio? And I think, you know, there are times when things get really cheap, when you want to be more aggressive. We're not there. There's times when interest rates look really attractive and maybe you say, okay, we put a little more in bonds in the portfolio because we can get you a little more returns. We're not there either. And so what's unique about where we are right now is that nothing about what we're doing is typical. Nothing about what we're doing is average in terms of where the economy is, in terms of where markets are. And yet I think the environment that we've entered is kind of pushing us back to that default position, where we don't want to be overly cautious because there just isn't enough return in a portfolio that is overly cautious. But at the same time, you're not getting paid to take the risks in stock that you got paid to take when we look back to where we were in March, when we look back to where we were in April, when we were willing to say, yeah, things look a little cheap, but there's reasons why they're cheap right now. And so, you know, I think if you're thinking, what should I do differently with my portfolio? The question you really need to ask yourself is long-term, how do I want to be allocated? Because that's probably where you want to be right now.
And I think people like to say these days, Kyle, trust the process, right?
Absolutely. It's worked for the 76ers if you're a basketball fan. So it might as well work for your investment portfolio. With no Joel this week, you know, we can just maybe touch on the economic indicators. If there's anything that jumps out to either you, Brian, or you, Steve, please let me know. But I think the big one, obviously, that everybody has been paying attention to since March is just the direction of kind of the unemployment rate, the direction of the employment picture. And clearly, as far as the economy is concerned, employment is really the driver of the bus. And so, you know, in July, the unemployment rate fell down to 10.2%. That is a good thing that it's coming down. But again, 10.2% is well above where we were leading into this crisis, and important to remember that there's still millions of people out of work right now. So, you know, until we can get a handle on the pandemic, until we can get a handle on what the post-crisis recovery looks like, I think it's going to be a lot of question marks about where the employment picture heads from here. And then you look at non-farm payrolls, you know, we saw better than what we thought we would see in July, with some restaurant reopenings helping hospitality and leisure employees. But, you know, again, it is not a pretty picture for the employment market. It is not a pretty picture for the labor market when, you know, you've got millions of people out of work. So I would say that's kind of the thing that most stands out from the employment data this last week. And then obviously some data on manufacturing and the non-manufacturing indexes. I think also pointing out that the economy maybe is a little bit ahead of where we thought it would be right now. But ultimately, we've got a ways to go to gain back a lot of what was lost in March and April. So, you know, in the absence of any other real news on the economy, it's more of the same. It's more of we're headed back in the right direction, but there's a lot of work to be done. Well, that's the end of yet another Money Talk. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next week.
Thank you for listening to Money Talk with Bob Landis. If you have a financial question you want answered on next week's show, email it to moneytalk@landis.com. To keep informed throughout the week, visit our Money Talk page at landis.com.